That's called the bitter motivation. Monastic vows have to be taken with at least the motivation of renunciation of cyclic existence and aspiration for liberation. So it's extremely important to cultivate that motivation before receiving the ordination, and even more important, to sustain that motivation afterwards. So to generate the aspiration for liberation, we have to see cyclic existence, samsara, as the hellhole that it is. We have to see it as binding and restricting and miserable as it actually is. And to do this means thinking about some things or observing things that make the mind of attachment extremely uncomfortable. So the asubha meditations, thinking about the ugly aspect of the body, the meditations on the various types of dukkha, the meditations understanding the causes of cyclic existence, and the factors that make them arise in our mind. We have to really gain some familiarity with those meditations so that we have a very strong aversion to cyclic existence. Not a panicky emotional aversion, but a wisdom, caution aversion. And then on the basis of seeing our own dukkha and wanting ourselves to be free, then we can look at the situation of other sentient beings, understand their dukkha, and wish them to be free. And it's upon that that we then generate bodhicitta. If we try to meditate on bodhicitta directly without facing our own situation, our own being trapped in samsara, we try and skip that and go to bodhicitta, our bodhicitta becomes kind of Mickey Mouse. Doesn't really hit the mark. So spend a couple of minutes thinking of your own situation in samsara, then generalize it to other living beings, and from there generate bodhicitta. So yes, you were talking about how initially the Sangha was just a group of individuals who were wanderers, and the Pratimoksha was very much for the ethical discipline of the individual. And as time went on, because of the rains retreat, having the rains retreat, because King Bimbisara went to the Buddha and said, you know, the monastics are stepping on plants and squishing insects as they're going for their alms in the monsoons. Then the Buddha started the custom of them staying put and not wandering for those 3 months. And so because of that, then, you know, you had the avasa and aramas. Okay, the avasas were the ones that were the monks outlined an area and built little huts, and the aramas where a wealthy benefactor came and offered the land, like Anatta Pindika offered the park at Shravasti. And so then the monastics stayed there during the 3 months, and they were required to leave after those 3 months and continue wandering. But then some of them started coming back to the same place every year. Okay? And you start having some upkeep on that, even though they were coming back every year. Then after a while, some of them weren't leaving at all, and the order began to, the monastics began to be a little bit more settled. And so then you needed, the community was accumulating property. And instead of having at the beginning, and still now, there's this idea of the Sangha of the Four Directions, okay, which means the Arya Sangha, all the monastics, were one big community. When they started getting settled, you know, initially they didn't become individual communities. But then when, after more and more time went on, and not only did they not go away after the rains retreat, but they stayed there and they accumulated property, and then you needed a manager and you needed somebody to greet the lay people, and you start having to organize things more. And then you had the advent of these monasteries, or linas, as they were called. And at that time, then you began to have these individual Sangha communities. Yeah. So you still had the idea of the Sangha of the four directions, but then one became affiliated with your own individual Sangha, because it was your own place that not only did you return year after year there, but you never really left in between. And so it became like more of a community, more of an institution, you know, the individual Sanghas. And so then when you had the boundaries set, because in the Vinaya we're always talking about setting boundaries, then a boundary was that area within which any monastics who lived there, you know, were entitled to join in the Sangha Karma, the actions of the karma of the people in that area. Okay? And so that became more, you know, you had many different areas and many different sanghas and different communities. What I find very interesting is this thing of how the community developed and how it became different in different Buddhist traditions even today. You know, and it's very curious. Like in Thailand, there's let's say the monks of Achan Cha's tradition, they all go very freely between each other's monasteries. You know, you spend some time at this one, then you spend some time at that one, and you're here and you're there, and that's fine. But even within Thailand, there's two major branches of Sangha, at least. I think there might be a third one, I'm not sure. But of these two major branches, one doesn't really recognize the ordination of the other. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go and stay in that monastery for any length of time, you have to reordain and get their monastic lineage. So you have this more of a division into Sangha, you know, more identity with your own particular monastery. I noticed when I was in Taiwan, it's quite amazing there. When you go into the different monasteries, if you're a monastic, they will give you a place to sleep and food, you know. I'm not sure necessarily how long they'll let you stay, but there were never any questions asked. And, even if I were like a visitor and they were doing some special ceremony that day when I would go in, boy, I was included in that ceremony. And they had a graduation one day. They put me in the front row with the masters, even though I was only visiting for a week. There was this real inclusion. And the Chinese have a great emphasis that any offerings that were made to the community on that day, there are certain offerings that are divvied up amongst the members of the community. So everybody who was there before noon, you know, when the offerings were made, was eligible to receive the offerings that were made to the entire community. It didn't matter whether you lived there, whether you didn't. Everybody shared those offerings equally. Of course, if a benefactor came in and gave something that couldn't be divided up amongst the members, then that was only for the Sangha, you know, for that particular community. And I remember when I went to Tibet, I was in Tashi Lumpo, and I wanted to go in, and they were doing puja, and I wanted to go in, and I was told, no, I couldn't go in. And then somebody explained, well, no, this is just for our monastics, not for outsiders. They aren't allowed to come in. And then when I was in South India at Ganden, you know, a few times I wanted to go join the pujas, and I was told, no, I couldn't go. And then when I asked why not, they said, well, anybody, because initially I thought it was because I was a nun, and then I found out, no, it wasn't just because I was a nun. It's anybody who's not a member of that monastery cannot go to their pujas because they pass out the offerings during the pujas, mm-hmm. and they only wanted to go for the monks of their monastery. Mm-hmm. So the Tibetans have a whole different thing. The Chinese are like, yeah, you're there, sure, come and share. And the Tibetan, no, this is, you know, kind of, even though you have all these monasteries there, it's very divided up according to who the offerings were made to. So it's just quite interesting how that developed in the various Buddhist countries and who recognizes whose ordination and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, because one of my Tibetan teachers, when he went to Thailand, His Holiness sent him to Thailand, the monks at the monastery he was staying wanted him to reordain in their tradition. They didn't accept his Tibetan ordination. So, you know, it's just interesting how it's happened. But you can see, you know, that it all, as soon as you get a great number of people and you divide it into individual communities, this kind of thing starts happening. So also when you had the individual communities, then you needed a storeroom, you needed a big hall for posada. Posada is the sojung, the renewal, confession and renewal of the precepts. You needed, you know, more things for katina. Katina is at the end of the rains, the three-month rains retreat, then the lay people come and offer cloth and offer robes. And so there's a big ceremony there. So you need a hall to hold it in and people to, you know, deal with the lay people and so on. Okay, so what happened is in the Pratimoksha, you know, or in the Vinaya, then what happened is a lot of the precepts became not just about ethical issues, but about how you live together as a community. Okay, so we actually talk about two kinds of actions or two kinds of faults, you could say. There's naturally negative actions. So that's an action like killing or stealing or lying, things like this, that anybody who does them, whether you have a precept or don't have a precept, you create negative karma. Okay? So some of our monastic vows have to do with these naturally negative actions. Yeah. Then there are other of the monastic trainings that they become things to be abandoned because the Buddha said so. So these are not things that are necessarily naturally negative. If a lay person did them, there would be no accumulation of any kind of fault. But if a monastic does them, there's a fault because there's something prohibited by the Buddha. Okay? So a lot of I shouldn't, I have to qualify this now. Okay, so some of the precepts that we had, and probably the initial ones that we had, were very much the naturally negative ones. Okay, you know, things that, not naturally negative precepts, but against the naturally negative actions. Okay, then there were other rules about how to live together, and some of them need not be naturally negative actions. Okay, there's all sorts of things about manners, about you don't slurp your food, and you know, you don't lick your bowl, and you don't stand with your hands on your hips, and you don't cross your legs, and you don't, you know, all these other kinds of things. And they're not naturally negative actions. Okay, they're things that the Buddha prohibited because they were unbecoming of a monastic. Okay, we have, you know, precepts not to ride in vehicles or not to go swimming or not to throw your chamber pot over the wall without looking where you're throwing it. you know, so these are not naturally negative actions, but they become things, you know, to be abandoned because the Buddha prohibited it. Okay, some of the things that are, you know, have to do with living together, I'm sure are naturally negative, but a great deal of them aren't. It's just things, it's just etiquette and not being rude, you know. Like you can't go and just kind of plop your, share a room with another monastic without asking them, or you can't, you know, demand that somebody teach you something. Okay, so all these things of etiquette that aren't necessarily, you know, big ethical faults, but they are just conducive for the community living together peacefully. Like the precept to not eat after midday. There's nothing naturally negative about eating after midday, but it does become a fault because the Buddha prohibited it. Or even taking intoxicants, it's not a naturally negative action, but it's definitely something to be abandoned because, you know, if you take them, then you wind up doing all the naturally negative ones. Okay, so it's one of those things that act like a fence for you. Okay, but if you look in the monastic vows, a lot of them have to do with just how you live together with other people. Okay, so you can see that these must have developed as the Sangha became more sedentary. Yeah, and then I should also probably clarify the difference between the Vinaya and the Pratimoksha. The Pratimoksha is part of the Vinaya. The Vinaya is just the whole topic of the monastic discipline. And it, I think it would include the five lay precepts also, because those are, you know, Pratimoksha, considered a type of Pratimoksha vows. But the Vinaya consists of many stories and many different rules and things that the Buddha said don't do and you can do, and the stories behind the precepts in the Pratimoksha. But the Pratimoksha itself is a list of the precepts that the monastics have. Okay, so the Pratimoksha itself is not too long. I mean, however long it takes to list the, you know, however many bhikshu or bhikshuni vows you have in whichever tradition you happen to be ordained in. Okay, so it's just a few pages. And then this is what's recited at the posada, the sojung ceremony for the fully ordained people. Okay, but the Vinaya has the stories that lie behind the different Pratimoksha precepts. And then the Vinaya contains a lot of other do's and don'ts, yeah, besides those contained in the Pratimoksha precepts, that just were, you know, came up in the process of, you know, people living together. And, you know, so the all the different things that the Buddha said about the kind of shoes to wear, and all the different things about the Buddha said about medicine. Okay, so you have these sections in the Vinaya that talk about, you know, these different things. And there's certain things you do and certain things you don't do in regards to all these different topics. The Vinaya also talks about what's called Sangha Karma, or the actions of the Sangha. And these refer to community actions. So again, this is something that must have developed later as the Sangha became more sedentary. Okay, because when they were wandering, people wouldn't necessarily know who blew it and who didn't. You know, and if you had a different group of people there for posada each time, they wouldn't know who had been admonished and who wouldn't. But when you started to have more sedentary or cenobitical communities, if I said the word right, you started to have these governing policies. Okay, so the Pratimoksha, some people, like historians and so on, they see it as like one of the first codes of law. You know, these are the laws that the people in this community are going to follow. However, most of us monastics see it as a code of training, like I was saying to you before, because it's trainings, it's how you train your mind. Yeah. Although the historians, like I say, see it as a code of law, because there were certain repercussions for breaking different things. But looking at it from the viewpoint of a monastic is you are training your mind in certain things, and if you blow it, the Sangha is there to admonish you and correct you. And, you know, if you won't accept admonishment and correction, then you sometimes, you know, lose certain privileges or things happen to you to really get it across to you that, hey, you know, you got to really check up your behavior here. Okay, so there became the Sangha Karmas, which are kind of like Robert's Rule of Order. You know, it's like how you conduct a function, and everything has to be done. Any conclusion that is reached, it's like a judiciary procedure, but not always in terms of the justice system meting out punishment or retribution. It's not like that, but it's okay. For example, if people are going to be ordained, that's a Sangha Karma. It's an action of the Sangha, meaning the entire community. And so there's certain procedures. Certain number of people need to be there. The procedure needs to be conducted in a certain way. Certain people cannot be there. Okay? So there's all these rules about it if an ordination is to be considered valid. Then there's, you know, the process of, I'll get into this a little bit more, but there's the second classification of vows that we have called suspensions or Sangha Visesas, or remainders, they're often called. And those ones, if you have to be disciplined for those, there has to be so many people, and this, you know, you have to be admonished 3 times in front of the whole group, and, you know, the procedure needs to be done correctly. So you began to have all these regulations and rules and guidelines about how to do community procedures so that they're legitimate. Okay, so this also happened when you started having settled communities, you know, you had to deal with how people live together. Okay, so it seems like, you know, like I said, it started out as wandering, and then very quickly, you know, you started having the 3 months vasa, you know, rainy seasons where you stayed put. And then it seemed like, you know, fairly quickly after that, then you start having the arisal of communities where they didn't leave between vasas. And so even within 100 years of the Buddha's parinirvana, you started to have these more settled communities. And then, of course, as time went on, for centuries after that, then the communities got more and more settled, and these individual sanghas, each with not only the Pratimoksha and the Vinaya that governed them, but then you would have your own individual guidelines for living at that monastery. Okay, so you see this when you travel to different monasteries, they'll all have their own guidelines about how you do this and how you do that, and when there's this and when there's that, and Okay, and so those ones, everybody who's living there has to follow, even though they're not one of the precepts. Okay? And then, just to finish up this development of the community. So you had these linas, you know, for quite a long time, and these were the monasteries. Some of them were caves, you know, a group of monks living together in a cave, in various caves and coming together for posada, to do ordination. And then you started, more of the benefactors offering land and building monasteries. And then around the 5th century A.D. is when you began to have the real rise of the monastic universities. Okay, I think some of them began to start in previous centuries, but then they became really quite strong starting around the 5th century A.D. And that was a result of what was going on in the society, because Buddhism was meeting some resistance from the general Hindu, culture. And actually, I mean, you still had many, many different religious traditions in India at that time. And there was a lot of debate going on about the views and the correct views. And so the large monastic universities formed in reaction to that, because the Buddhists had to get together and, you know, get their philosophical positions ironed out and learn how to debate and learn proper debating procedures and so on, so that they can refute the ideas of the non-Buddhists. Because you still had that custom of, if your ideas were refuted, you had to convert to the other person's religion. Okay? So the monastic universities were very much designed to, you know, it, many times you had non-Buddhists living there, but if that was so, it was to learn their ideas so that you could learn how to refute them. Okay? So, you know, very much at that time, you know, Dinaga was in the 5th century, and then Dharmakirti the following century, you know, they were the big logicians. And, you know, their big thing was to develop a system of logic that the Buddhists could use to refute the non-Buddhist tenet systems. Okay? So, this, you know, when you get the Tibetan monasteries, this is where they came from, you know, because what happened around that time, the 5th century, is that the smaller monasteries, many of them closed, and the Sangha became much more centralized at these large ones, like, you know, Nalanda or Vikramasila or Dantapuri. And actually, you know, although that was done to refute the non-Buddhists, because the Sangha became so centralized in these few places, then when you have the Mughal invasions and the Muslims coming in the 12th century, the Sangha were really easy targets, because all you had to do was, you know, attack a few of these monasteries and you wipe them all out. And it was very different, you know, because you had a lot of the Hindus and they were very widespread. They didn't have these big institutions, so they were very popular in the villages. So Hinduism continued even after the Muslim invasion, whereas Buddhism was really knocked out because they were more isolated from the lay people and more just in these, you know, universities. But since Buddhism started going to Tibet during the time when these universities existed, then the Tibetans really inherited this whole system of debate quite early on. What I find interesting is in ancient India, it was used very much to refute the non-Buddhists and to refute the lower philosophical schools in Buddhism, because as time went on, you got the development of more philosophical schools. So they were debating each other and trying to refute each other too. Okay, so the debate system was very much to, defend one's own school or one's own position. Not just for the sake of defending it, but really it was an investigation into truth. But there were, you know, different schools forming and to discuss in this way. What happened in Tibet is, you know, very quickly the whole country became Buddhist. So using debate to refute non-Buddhists, which was the main purpose of it starting, you know, it stopped. And to refute the lower schools where there were no Vaibhasikas and Satantrikas in Tibet. So that stopped. So they still had some debate amongst, you know, like Tsongkhapa and Datsang and different people. You know, they would debate each other in different positions, but it was a little bit different, you know, than before. And nowadays, in the different schools, they don't seem to debate amongst each other at all. I've never heard of it happening. And debate now is used as a tool to help students learn the material. Yeah. Or in some cases, you know, if students are really using debate to investigate the nature of reality, you know, some of them use it that way, but some of them use it just as a pedagogical tool to learn the material. So I just find it's interesting how the purpose of something, you know, changes. And I'm just speaking in very big generalizations here, but I find that interesting. And how even, you know, in classical Tibet at the time, you know, when you had like 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th century, a lot of debate amongst the Tibetans going on. And now, you know, they don't. Yeah. So, you know, and when Buddhism first came to Tibet, there was this thing of, you know, well, we really have to debate to figure out what the great masters mean. So there's all this exploratory thing and, you know, what do the masters really mean and unpacking what the masters mean. And now there's very much the feeling of, well, everybody's unpacked everything and it's just our job to learn it. There's nothing to add to the great masters and you do not dare refute one of the great masters. So very much now there's not an impetus towards a lot of creative thinking in the Tibetan monasteries. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea is more of, you know, they've all said it, they've unpacked it, they know what's the right view, we just have to learn it. So I find all of this interesting because if it helps you see how what our current practice is developed in light of the history of a certain society and what was going on at that certain time and what was going on in the culture and all these things. Yeah. And I say this simply because, you know, when I came to Buddhism, it was presented as this is the way things are. And, you know, the Tibetans were never, European colonial movement never touched the Tibetans. I mean, there was young husbandmen incursion, but that was it. They were never colonized. So they didn't get the whole influence of Western education. So, for example, in Tibet, there's no field of study that is anthropology or sociology or political science. They don't have those fields of study. Even history, they're not real good on history. Yeah, trying to get some specific Buddhist history, it's, you know, that's not what they learn, or, you know, or accurate history. All the biographies are hagiographies with all these flowery things, you know, to get what actually happened is a bit tough. Anyway, so, you know, they don't have the system of being able to step back and look at their own culture. You know, and they never ask what's Buddhism and what's Tibetan culture. For them, it's just all the same. It's all, that's it. Yeah. And so as a Westerner, I found that very important for me after some years is to try and learn, well, what is Buddhism and what's Tibetan culture? Because, you know, I want to practice Buddhism, but I don't want to necessarily practice Tibetan culture. But I don't want to throw the Buddha out with the bathwater, you know, thinking that something that's the Dharma is just culture. Yeah. So it's, to me, understanding the history and how these different things developed helped me really discriminate, okay, what is Dharma and what is culture? And so as we come to the West, what things do we bring that we absolutely do not change, and what things are forms that can be modified, and what's the meaning behind those forms, and which meanings are cultural and which meanings are Dharma, because which, you know, can we alter and which shouldn't we? Okay, but that got off way on another tangent here, okay? But just, you know, why I think seeing the history and the culture and how things developed in different countries is quite useful, yeah? And then for me, also thinking about karma and seeing how the Chinese, you know, accept anybody who comes in and share the offerings, and their monasteries are very wealthy. And the Tibetans, you know, if you're not a part of their monastery, you can't come in and share those offerings. And, you know, they've been having, now some of them are getting more wealthy, but a lot of financial problems. And so what's the karma? You know, how is that relating to karma in there? Anyway, just some things to think about, not in terms of praising or criticizing, but, you know, how are we going to do things here? You know, what can we learn from past examples for how we want to do things here?